Bostic with Samaritan Regional Medical Center. And most recently, I've been doing some palliative care, so my career has kind of spanned everything from the intensive care unit to end-of-life issues. I'm chairman of the Ethics Committee at Good Samaritan Regional Medical Center, and medical ethics and politics of ethics and politics of medicine is an area of interest. I've been coming up here. This is my wife, Gay, and she will help me and keep me on time, I hope. I've been coming up here since 1999 or 1998, it's not sure, and running a program like this. It's usually four or five lectures and seminars on various aspects of health as we get into the 21st century. We were here exactly 10 years ago at 9/11 2001. And this was a very special place to experience that, and I think it has colored our response to that, and that's something that we might, over coffee or dinner or lunch or something, kind of chat about, because I think experiencing 9/11, the real 9/11 here, where there was no television, almost no radio, no internet, no outside communication, was really very, very different than what the majority of Americans experienced at that time. These sessions are by necessity, I will cover a lot of information, and so we will use PowerPoint. I don't really like PowerPoint. Much better if we just have a discussion. But there's a lot of basic information, and I think I would like to look at these sessions as a starting point of a discussion that will continue up there in the cafeteria or wherever we might be enjoying a cup of coffee and, amongst each other. We all have experiences with the healthcare system. And I hope more than anything else, these sessions will raise questions, will start us to think about what's going on with our healthcare system, with what constitutes health, with how we can live healthier, more productive lives individually and collectively, and how we look at that from a wider view. We have pictures of our neighbors here. They certainly are cute, but they can be problematic. Holden Village, it just is a very special place, and I like to think of it as a place where the arts and aesthetics cross with ethics and science, where this all can come together, and it's just a unique environment. We love coming back here. This is the first of four sessions. We're going to talk about medicine in the 21st century. These are the four sessions we're going to talk about. The first one is looking at medicine and health and healthcare from a personal, regional, national, and world view. Tomorrow there'll be a session on what we call successful or healthy aging, something that I think most of us are interested in achieving. And I think people at Holden Village seem to have done an especially good job, especially of the older folks, those of us with gray hair who come back here. I think it's a very interesting group of people who have aged in a very successful fashion. On Wednesday, there are two sessions, one on spirituality, religion, and health, and the interaction and how those factors affect our health. And the last session will be an introduction to medical ethics and a little bit about end of life. And that's usually something that generates a lot of interest and a lot of subsequent discussion. So, but the session today, this is what we're going to be talking about. We're going to talk about definitions of health and healthcare, metaphors of how we look at the medical care system, different perspectives from a personal or more global perspective. I want to say something about determinants of health. And if there's one thing that I hope everyone takes away from here will be a better understanding, or at least an understanding, of what really determines health. What are the factors that really makes a society healthy, makes an individual healthy? Because I think we have a warped sense of what that is in this country and in other parts of the world. Then we'll have some fun looking at what's the best healthcare system in the world. Look at different models. There's certainly, if you talk to the politicians in Washington, they will tell you that we have, you'll hear it over and over, we have the best healthcare system in the world. And that's, we'll see if we agree with that. Look at different models, and then how can we, are we moving in the right direction? Are we going to get in the right direction of actually achieving the goals of health? The goals of health should be that we have a healthy population, not necessarily that we have more health care. And those two may or may not align with each other. So what's health? Anybody want to give me their own personal definition of what health is?
When you can walk up to Holden without stopping.
That's a pretty good definition. Of course, it wouldn't apply to a newborn, would it?
No.
It's maintaining physical capability, right? That certainly would be part of it. What else?
Absence of dis-ease.
Absence of, and I like the way you pronounce that, dis-ease, because that relates to symptoms as well as, because some of the aging symptoms that we all experience are really less disease than they are just an aging process. We'll talk more about aging. Anything else?
A state of well-being.
State of well-being. What's well-being?
That you are well, and you're being who you are as a person are sure. As well.
More than just your physical characteristics or physical parts. Any other thought? The World Health Organization has defined health. All kinds of agencies have defined health, but basically what the World Health and the CDC, which is the Center for Communicable Diseases in the United States, a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, get back to well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. So it takes on a little bit more than just the absence of disease or disability. Other definitions, they talk about a dynamic state of complete physical, mental, spiritual, and social well-being. A state of physical and emotional well-being. Absence of disease is certainly part of it, but there seems to be a broader sense of what health is. And that ultimately should be our goal. In a healthcare system and in what a society. And is health itself a goal? It probably is, because it's certainly absence of symptoms, absence of limitations, fulfillment in our life, but certainly our ability as a nation or society to be functional is very much dependent on having a healthy population. Not only is our sick people a drain on the population, but healthy people can be productive. When we look at medicine and understanding medicine, there are a whole bunch of metaphors for medicine, which I like to just kind of toss out. One of the old ones people lost their health. We say that, you know, so-and-so lost their health, and it's sort of like it's some kind of personal inadequacy as to why someone is ill. Another metaphor for health is to be stricken. You're stricken with disease. Mm-hmm. You have a stroke. It's sort of like, you know, God has picked you out, and it'd be probably because you did something bad, and that's why you became ill. So that whole thing about a stroke, the grip, I guess what many of us are old enough to remember, we had the grip. That was, it was a disease, the grip, specifically back in the 1800s, was described as a disease of pleurisy frequently, and it was the devil's grip. That's where it came from. Then grip became more loosely, you'd have the intestinal grip or you had the flu, but it was the devil's grip, and pleurisy is a severe pain when you take a deep breath. And it was like the devil had his claws in your chest, and every time you went to breathe, he just dug those claws in. So that's where that term devil's grip came from. And so it was sort of historically, the anger of the gods taking advantage, punishing us for something. In this country, we've used the military metaphor, part of our military industrial complex and now the medical industrial complex, so that we have a heart attack, it's an attack, we have invasive cancer, so it's an invading force in the body. Physicians and nurses are fighters, and we refer frequently to our medical armamentarium. Have you heard that term? It's really very much, and it is a war on cancer, and we win the fight, and the new treatments for cancer are actually search and destroy. That all came on after the Vietnam War. It's sort of amazing how we've taken that. We have a technical or technician metaphor for disease, that way the physician in the medical system is a certain element of competence. As a commercial metaphor, where we've got involved with entrepreneurship and HMOs and all that kind of stuff, and ultimately the term doctor means teacher, and so that metaphor is that really the role of the medical profession and medicine and healthcare should be to teach and instruct and to give advice to individuals and to society up to how to achieve that healthy life, which is our goal. Any questions about that? That's just sort of a fun way of thinking how we think about medicine often determines on what we do. It's sort of like after 9/11, it was going to be the war on terror. And so it had to be a war. I mean, we use a different terminology, a different metaphor, maybe we would have responded differently. Mm-hmm. And so the words do shape the way we approach them. And they're very powerful. And I think they're much more powerful than any of us think. Okay, now it's Gay's job to fill in the blanks over here. We're gonna go from kind of defining health as individuals to look at metaphors of how we look at health. Now let's just kind of look around the world. And I picked out 5 countries, kind of at random. Not USA, certainly not at random. Canada's our neighbor just to the north of us here, obviously. Picked a country in Europe, Denmark, looked at China because it's the biggest country in the world. I picked Afghanistan because it's one of the poorest countries and it's a country that we are intimately involved in. So let's just look at, and I've listed a number. This is all from WHO data. It's all available on the internet. But sometimes it's just instructive to get an idea about what's going on in the world. You know, are we really that different from other countries? So our GDP, our population, let's just run with the population across. United States, 314 million. Oh, is that not writing well?
It's okay.
If you twist it, it may. Okay, 314. Canada is 33. Denmark is 5.4. You don't have the right million, but. China is 1,350 million, which is 1.3 billion. And Afghanistan has 28 million people. So Afghanistan's about the size of Canada. Okay, what's the GDP per capita? So this would be take the gross domestic product divided by the population. And we've got, the United States is about 47,000. We just put the, sorry, that's the only pen we have here. 47,000. Canada is 38,000. Denmark is 37,000. And China is 6,000. And Afghanistan, so the GDP of Canada is China is $6,000 per person, and Afghanistan is $1,100. That comes out to roughly $3 a day. So they have $3 per day. We have they have $1,000. We have $47,000. Life expectancy at birth. Next column. United States is, this is males and females, so it's 76/81. Women always live a little bit longer than men, you'll see. Canada, 79/83, a little bit better than we do. Denmark, 77/81, about the same. We're all in that same ballpark. Now, here's what's going to surprise you a little bit. China, 72/76. Mm-hmm. better life expectancy than I think most of us would think as a developing country with lots of poverty. And Afghanistan, 47 and 50. Now, let me say just something about life expectancy at birth. That's the average age that the population will die at. And so if you get a 100-year-old person that one person lives to 100 and one child dies at birth, right after birth, you have a life expectancy of 50. So you can see how a high infant mortality will skew life expectancy. And this is really true when you look at it historically when you look back 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago or at the time of Christ, and we'll talk about this in the aging conference tomorrow. The life expectancy at the time of Christ was about 25 years or something like that.
Wow.
But it wasn't that you expected everybody to die at 25. There were plenty of 60 and 70-year-old people back at the time of Christ. But there was, infant mortality was so high, so it skewed it. And as we have had a real impact on infant mortality, it changes that. So let's look at early mortality. This is the probability that a child that is born alive will be dead by the age of 5 per 1,000. So United States is 8. It'd be a better pen than that.
Well, it's brand new. I got her some brand new ones.
Okay. United States is 8. Canada is 6.
Just give them a chance to
look. There you go. Canada is 6. Denmark is 4. China is 19. So you can see how the Chinese, the life expectancy is influenced. And Afghanistan is 199.
Wow.
So that's out of 1,000. So that means that roughly 1 out of 5 children will die in Afghanistan before. Those are new ones?
Yeah, they are. Brand new, yeah.
This must be made in China. All right. So that just gives you an idea about infant mortality, and it's interesting that United States and Canada are a little bit United States is double what Denmark is. Denmark's a smaller country, more urban country. When you have large rural areas, getting prenatal care is a little more difficult. So that countries like Australia, Canada, United States, Russia have some higher infant mortality. A lot of that is based. Well, it's based on a whole bunch of things, but one of the things it's based on is the rural population. So the next column is the probability of dying between 15 and 60. So this gives you, this is the productive years of your life. For the United States, it's 134 over 78. Again, women, this is male to female. Men, 134 chance per 1,000 they're going to die during that 45 years. Women, 78. In Canada, for men, it's 87, considerably lower, and 53, considerably lower. In Denmark, it's 107, 65. China is 142 and 87, which is remarkably similar to the United States. One would think, for a country that is as rich as we are, that somehow, you know, we would have lower mortality there. And in Afghanistan, it's 440 over 352. Now, a lot of that is traumatic. This is the data from 2009. They've been in a wartime, and a lot of other things in that country. Now, how much do we spend per capita? $7,410 in the United States.
Spend, does that mean health care?
Health care. We spend $7,000 of our 47,000 on health care per person.
Is that inpatient also?
I'm sorry?
Is that inpatient stays also?
That's inpatient, outpatient, visits to the chiropractor, out-of-pocket, purchase of pharmaceuticals, whatever. Canada spends $4,196. So they spend just a little over half of what we spend. Denmark spends $4,118, which is essentially the same. China spends $309 per person. And Afghanistan spends $69 per person on that. And as a percentage of GDP, the United States spends 16.2. Canada spends 10.9. 11.2 in Denmark. 4.6 in China. And 7.4% in Afghanistan. Afghanistan actually spends a larger percentage of their GDP, but hardly anything in terms of money. China spends a small amount of money, a small amount of the GDP on healthcare. So we could kind of look
Time to go back to your slide.
We could kind of look at that and say, you know, is there, you know, what kind of conclusions can you draw from that? Obviously, great inequities in the world, both in terms of our GDP, in terms of how much we spend on healthcare, and
move to Canada.
Canada looks pretty good, doesn't it? Canada, Denmark looks pretty good. Yes, sir.
Is that 7,000? Does that include insurance? Would
yes.
That include insurance premiums?
Yeah. Okay. Well, it would include. Yes, because it includes the profit that goes into the insurance company. I mean, it doesn't get counted twice because, like, if you pay $10,000 a year for insurance and then get $8,000 worth of benefits and it's $2,000, it's still the $10,000 is what it counts.
Okay.
Yes.
This is a slice in time. I'd be curious to know if you know there's some dramatic changes in the last 10, 25 years on each category. We had a friend who just came back from Zimbabwe, for example, and he said that the life expectancy in Zimbabwe has dropped from 65 to 35.
Oh. Yeah, that is sub-Saharan Africa because of the AIDS epidemic. And it's almost exclusively because of AIDS.
Total political continent confusion and
sure.
Chaos.
And it has changed. Life expectancy has in the Western countries has gradually increased. The United States is, and we'll talk about that tomorrow, we have some of the data on the population changes. The United States had, every country has spent a little bit more on healthcare as a percentage of GDP and as a total amount. The United States has been a dramatic change over the past 25 years. We've gone where we were down around 10%, we are now up to it's estimated this year is going to be over 17% of our GDP, and that's close to $2 trillion of our we're spending on healthcare, which is huge. All right, Gay has told me it's time to move on back to the slide. So that gives kind of a world view. I want you to take this slide, and I have a couple handouts that go along with this. This is what I want you to concentrate on for a couple minutes here. I'm not spend too much time on it in a moment. Sure, hand them up. I just want to show this slide first. The whole theme when we come up here every year, there's a theme. The theme this year was to share in the many colored grace of God. And I just couldn't figure how that was going to work in anything I'm talking about. So what we're handing out is some colors on those graphs. I just want to let you know that I take my charge very seriously. But this is what I want you to look at this, because this is what determines whether you as an individual and whether society as a whole is healthy. And if I were to ask you, you'd probably think, you want to have a good EMT system and hospitals around and clinics and access to physicians and all that kind of stuff. But really what determines whether you're healthy or not are some other factors that are much less clear. Your socioeconomic status. Health, disease is not distributed equally in society. I think all of us know that. Intuitively, we know that if college-educated people live longer than people that don't have a college education, people who are higher on the socioeconomic ladder do better in a whole variety of things. Now, there's a lot of reasons for that. Some of them are habits. If you look at who smokes in society, it is not your PhDs and your CEOs. In fact, it was only, I think the last thing I saw in Forbes was that of the Fortune 500 companies, only one CEO smoked. Now the and I don't think that was R.J. Reynolds even. it has become kind of a taboo is amongst the educated classes and the higher socioeconomic groups in this country, whereas the general population is 24% smoke. So it's very and so health habits kind of get tied in with the social economic status, but the social economic status really is a major determinant of how long you can live. Genetic factors play a significant role. The environment plays a role, but not a huge role, but certainly clean water, clean air certainly is important. And healthcare, 10% of, and multiple studies have demonstrated this, that it really, and I think our little graph over here kind of shows that. You can spend an awful lot of money on healthcare and not really have a lot to show for it. So that's kind of the image I want you to take home. There's one more handout, Gabe, which talks about the social determinants of health. No color on that one. But I just would like you to kind of think about that when we think about healthcare and what if our goals are health. Do we really want to concentrate so much on healthcare, or do we really want to start thinking about other things? So social inequities, the larger the social inequities are in society, the greater the differential between the rich and the well-to-do and the poor, the sicker the whole society is going to be. And pouring more money into healthcare, I think a legitimate question is, can we spend too much money on healthcare? We'll kind of get to that. Golden is a great place, isn't it? So let's have some fun here and see who has the best healthcare system in the world. Before we get into any questions about the determinants, does this strike a note with you, or do you say, gee, Dr. Hall is out in left field someplace, or socialist or something, does it make sense?
She's making sense.
All right, so if we're going to look for around the world, we're going to take a quick tour around the world and define the best healthcare system. Now we're just going to talk about healthcare system. We've talked about health determinants. Healthcare system is a piece of that. It's a small piece of it, but it gets a lot of attention. So we could say it's the most expensive system must be the best, or the least expensive system might be the best, or maybe we really want an efficient system. We could look at life expectancy, we'll look at infant mortality, and that's one way of defining it. We could look at which country or which system seems to have be free of disability and disease. That was something that was mentioned early on when we defined health. We have universal coverage, and when we refer to universal coverage, we're talking about covering everybody, not everything. That's a big distinction, and a lot of people don't make that distinction. Universal coverage refers that everybody gets access to the healthcare system, not that everybody gets everything they want or thinks they need or that their physician thinks they need. We run into this thing with unlimited demand and limited resources. I mean, that is something that we all have in our lives. And then accessibility, we get in that rural, urban divide, and do we have a fair system? So there's different ways of looking at it. So let's look at health expenditure as a percentage of GDP, and we just look at a few countries. We looked at a few over here. Now let's just look at some others. United States, 16%. Switzerland, the next one down. Seems like most of the developed countries that we think of as having good healthcare systems are in that 9 to 10% range. We are an outlier. We spend more in healthcare than anybody else. We spend roughly 50% more than everybody else. And we look at the numbers, and they don't seem to indicate that we really necessarily have better health. So where's that money going? And if we recognize that healthcare contributes less than 10% to health, the determination of health, is it possible for a nation to spend too much on healthcare?
Definitely.
And that's a real question that we ought to think about. Because if we spend, if we have limited resources and we put it into one basket, then we have less for the other baskets. And if social economic factors are the number one determinant of whether you have a healthy society, does it make any sense to be pouring money into Medicare and Medicaid and health care and taking it out of the education system and taking it out of cleaning and keeping the environment clean, or taking it out of other areas that are that do impact on health? And I would, from my own personal point of view, I would say yes, we spend too much on health care, and I'm a physician. I don't get too much. It's those surgeons that get too much. All right. Let's get back on. So we said the most expensive, least expensive. I mean, obviously, we don't want to be like Afghanistan and don't have to spend hardly any money and have horrible infant mortality. We may not want to be like the United States and spend too much. So we can look at some of these other things that we talked about. So let's look at life expectancy, just again to kind of see where we rank in the world. Japan has the best life expectancy, 82.6 years overall. Again, you see right across the board, women live longer than men. They have easier lives and less Right, Jay? All right, so Canada is right 11. We rank 38th in the country, just below Cuba and above Portugal. So, but there's lots of things. I can say, you know, that infant mortality skews things. There's a lot of things to go into life expectancy. Maybe that's not the best index, but it is an index of how healthy the population is. And I think most of us would rather live in a place that has a longer life expectancy than a shorter life expectancy, especially if the quality of life is good. So let's look at infant mortality. And what's wrong here? You know, Japan, Finland, Sweden, Norway, France all have significantly lower infant mortality than the United States.
That's interesting. Why is that?
Why do you think?
Socioeconomic.
You are a smart man. Yeah, right on. You know that socioeconomic, the rural, the geographic problem. There are geographic problems. If somebody is pregnant and lives somewhere in rural Montana, for them to get good access to health care is going to be difficult. And so that is an issue. That's true in Canada. That's why Canada has is ranked 20th in the nation and not third or fourth. So bigger countries. So that does play a role. Social economic factors clearly do. Drug abuse, the underserved. So and if you go by state, there's a huge difference. The urban northern states tend to have lower mortality, and the rural southern states, especially Mississippi, Alabama, places like that, have very much higher infant mortality rates. They just don't get the prenatal care. And they're poor states.
You also have to throw in the cultural differences in some cultures than in the United States. I think I'm a nurse, and as a nurse, the differences that I've seen in cultures, especially with unplanned pregnancies or young pregnancies. I mean, you have to think about definitely unplanned pregnancies, pregnant women that have gotten pregnant at a young age or at an older age, and in different cultures how that's viewed, and how those people either come alongside that person or how they just leave that person. And in the United States, and maybe other countries that are low, I mean, that can lead to infant mortality.
I think that you mentioned really really important points. That's exactly right. One of the other issues is the access to abortion.
Yeah.
So if you have a mother, a pregnant woman that does not want to have that child or feels they really can't take care of that child and carries that pregnancy to term, and then has, that child has a much higher chance of dying in the perinatal period or in the early years of life than does a child that comes into a family that does want that child. So yeah, there are a lot of factors that go into it, but socioeconomic factors, cultural factors do play a major role. Okay, what about disability and disease, the absence of disability? So there is a scale which is used by epidemiologists around the world. It's called the Dale scale, which is the disability adjusted life expectancy. So this says how many years, if you at birth, how many years can you expect not only to live, but to live reasonably free of major disability? And they define major, stroke, incapacitating arthritis, all these kinds of things. And as you look at this scale, it's another way of looking at, I think it's an excellent way of looking at, because that's really what we were interested in, is what is our major productive years. And you see the United States, we're down there between Israel and Cyprus. And you know, we're not up with Australia and France and Sweden where we think we ought to be. It's not a huge difference, but it's 4 years. But 4 years of, on average, of less quality life or lower quality life is something. So we don't really rank up there at the top. WHO ranks countries. They take a whole lot of things into consideration and comes out with a ranking. They do this every year, and it's always poo-pooed by the U.S. government and by the politicians and by the medical profession. Says, well, they don't know what they're doing. France and Italy says, boy, they really know what they're doing. And San Marino, there's a lot of little countries, so that when you rank 37th, you got Oman and, where are these places? So United States on the WHO ranking in, I think this is 2008, ranked us 37. Now, one of the problems with the United States is this criterion of fairness. And we rank very badly on fairness. I don't think there's anybody that if they got run over by a truck or were shot or had a heart attack in a relatively urban or relatively large suburban area would think that the care they're going to get in the United States is 37th in the world. I mean, it isn't. It's right up there. It's either number one or it's in the top five. We provide really high quality, superb care under those circumstances. But when you factor in the fact that we have 47 million Americans have no health insurance, mm-hmm. and have limited access. Mm-hmm. And we factor in the fact that people go bankrupt because they have one illness and that impacts their health for years to come. Then we don't rank very high on those criteria. So WHO doesn't rank us very high. The Commonwealth Fund takes a lot of that into consideration, and they come up with a world ranking. All of these things are available on the internet if you want to look into them. Again, you see some of the same countries, they're very similar rankings. France, Japan, Spain, Italy, the Scandinavian countries always are up there at the top. The United States just doesn't make it for a whole lot of reasons. We spend a lot of money, but there we are, 15th on the... Newsweek last year, so last year we were out here, and this is the August 30th issue of Newsweek from 2010, the best country in the world. They came out with on a variety of rankings for it, and so this was very current last year. It was like 1 week, it was a week old when I was sadly last week and held this up. But anyway, they came out with their ranking, but they only ranked everything by the top 10. A good American magazine like this can't put the United States in the top 10. So there we have those same countries that appear at the top, the Scandinavian countries, Japan, Spain, Italy. So United States didn't even make it. All right.
Even the chipmunks are obese.
Only at Holden. They don't hike up to Heart Lake, you know, they just hang around here. So, here's a myth. The United States has the best system in the world. It would be very hard to defend that. And so when you hear people say that, and politicians say that, it's kind of unfortunate. Europe, Canada, and here's another myth. Europe, Canada, the rest of the developed world, they have socialized medicine. Boy, that's something we don't want in this country. With government-controlled providers and unhappy patients and long waiting lines. So that's a myth. You'll hear that all the time, too. And that's not true. And we'll talk about how that's not true. And those systems in those foreign countries, they're just they're foreign. They're not gonna work. I mean, Americans are different. We're better, of course, we know that. I thought the one of the hymns last night, the hymn about the blue skies and the dreams that we have and the dreams that they have, and I thought that was just beautiful last night. I thought that was very touching and a very well chosen hymn. Okay, so what can we learn? How are we on time? We have time. What can we learn from other countries? So we just found out that other countries seem to do a better job. If you listen to the politicians and you listen to some of the American leaders, medical leaders, they're going to say, well, we can't do that in this country because it's too foreign, too socialized, too rationed care. I mean, you know, it's just, we don't want that. Okay, there's a great book. T.R. Reid wrote this book. I think it's in the bookstore.
It is in the bookstore, I saw it.
It's The Healing of America. If you want to know about... He had a bad shoulder. This is a correspondent that he's written for Atlantic and New Yorker and all kinds of places. But he had an old injury, his shoulder. He went to multiple countries around the world to see how they would treat his shoulder. You know, United States, wow, we replaced the shoulder, of course, you know, we got titanium and all kinds of stuff, we can fix it, you know, and other places they say, well, you know, live with it. All right, but he really gives a very good review about how medical practices in other parts of the country and other parts of the world and how other countries have this system. And he has demonstrated in this book, he is... outlined very clearly how the rest of the world functions and how we function in terms of our healthcare system. So, four basic models of healthcare delivery. This is the other point I'd like you to take home from today's conference. There's the Bismarck model, the Beveridge model, and that's spelled wrong. It's not Beveridge, it sounds like a drinking model, doesn't it? The National Health Insurance model and the out-of-pocket model. Okay, so let's just see what these are. Okay, Bismarck. Otto von Bismarck, and that's the correct spelling is the one in the where it says Otto von Bismarck. It has a C in there. He was the Prussian chancellor back in the 1800s, really defined the welfare state in Germany. Created a situation in which employers provided health insurance by private companies for employees working in Prussia at the time. And the providers were private entities. So insurance companies are private. They're non-profit. They cover everybody. Premiums are collected from employers and employees. Those people that are not working, the government chips in and pays for their insurance. But it's all done through insurance, and it's all done through private insurance companies and private entities. There's tight government regulation. In other words, insurance policies have to cover certain services. And they control the costs of hospitals and physicians and providers. But it is all private. So when and Germany uses that system, Japan uses the system, France, Belgium, Switzerland all use that system of healthcare delivery. It's not socialized medicine the way we think about it. It's a different system, and so that's the Bismarck model of healthcare. And those countries, plus a number of others, have adopted that kind of system. Japan has like 100 different private insurance companies that provide, but they all provide the same coverage. They're all nonprofit. They all provide the same package of benefits, and they compete on service and things of that sort, as opposed to excluding. And they can't exclude people. They have to take money. There's no pre-existing condition exclusions or age exclusions or any of that sort in Germany and Japan. That's the Bismarck model. That's one model of healthcare delivery that seems to work, because all those countries do very well on every criterion that we use for assessing the healthcare system. Okay, the Beveridge model, William Beveridge. My spelling is I've got it spelled one way above, correctly above, and incorrectly below. I don't know.
We'll have a drink later.
He was a social reformer in the British National Health Service that you've all heard about. They run a very efficient service. It may not be ideal. Healthcare is provided for and financed by the government through tax payments. So it's pretty much like having a fire department or a library. Taxes are collected. The system is set up. There's no medical bills. Medical care is a public service. Many clinics and hospitals are owned by the government. Doctors are both employed and private, but many of them are employed. And low cost because the government controls everything. So this is what people think of when they think of socialized medicine. They think that all the rest of the world has socialized medicine. It's not. Great Britain has it. Italy and Spain have it. Scandinavia pretty much has it. So that those countries do have socialized medicine. They do have a lot. The government essentially runs the whole system. Cuba runs it. Hong Kong runs it. And I pointed out there, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs runs it. So the veterans doctors are employed. Taxes go supply to hospitals. If you're eligible as a veteran, then you get the similar kind of system as you would get in Sweden or Spain or Italy. So that's the Beveridge with the DG, not the drinking beverage. The National Health Insurance model. This is the single payer that you hear about. This is what Canada has. It has a little bit of the elements of both the Bismarck and the Beveridge models. Providers are private, but the payer is the government. The government pays all the bills. So it's not, you don't have private insurance companies. You have the government running, sort of like the Medicare system. You have a single payer, and costs are controlled by limiting services, making patients wait if they have to, negotiating lower fees with the providers. So the providers are private. So individual practitioners or clinics, individual hospitals, but they all contract with the government, which pays. So that's the National Health Insurance model. That's a little different from the Bismarck model, which is all free enterprise with nonprofit insurance companies, and the Beveridge model, which is the British model, which is the government runs everything. And finally, we have the out-of-pocket model. Only the developed countries have a real healthcare system. If you go to the third world, there'll be doctor's offices and there'll be hospitals, and you'll have to pay. So they don't have, by and large, they don't have health insurance programs. They don't have governmental-run programs. They're just too poor. So in Afghanistan, if you have some money, you can get yourself to a hospital, then you can get some care. If you don't have money, you don't have access to the hospital, then you're not going to get care. So the rich get care, the poor stay sick or die or recover on their own. Medical care is available to the well-to-do. Rural care is largely unavailable. And so the care is paid for by the patient out of pocket. If they have money, they can buy the care they need. In Cambodia, 91% of all the care is out of pocket. So there are some international companies there that do have insurance. There are some government employees that have insurance or have access to care. But India is 85% is out of pocket. Great Britain is 3%. So Great Britain, which has universal access, has a government-funded thing, still some people buy additional services or different services. And if you're rich, there is sort of a in Great Britain, there is a parallel system of some private hospitals that you can go to and have your surgery done there, and you can get your hip done, you know, that same week, as opposed to waiting, you know, 4 months in the British National Health System to wait for that surgery. In the United States, about 17% of our expenses are out of pocket. So it's four models, and these four models we should be able to understand because we have elements of each of those in the United States. We don't have one of those systems, but we have elements. So, okay, so if you're a working person under the age of 65, how many under 65 is working here? A couple, few. You might as well be in Germany, France, or Japan.
Yeah.
Because the worker and employer share the premium, the insurer pays most of the payout to private providers. That's, so the working class in America, under 65, is the same system that Germany, Japan, and France have. Okay, if you're a Native American, or military personnel, or a veteran who's eligible, you might as well live in Britain or Cuba. Because the providers are government employees working in government-owned clinics and hospitals, and you don't see a bill. You get your care. You're Indian Health Service, you're out on a reservation, you just go to the Indian Health Service hospital or clinic and you get your service. Same thing with veterans. If you're over 65, we might as well live in Canada. We have a national health insurance scheme, which is called Medicare. Don't touch my Medicare. But don't have national health insurance because it's social. It's phenomenal, the inconsistency that we hear, especially from the Tea Party. For the 45 million uninsured Americans, you might as well live in Cambodia or India. They have access if they can pay it, or if they're so sick, we have a law in this country that says nobody is going to bleed to death on the street. So they're scooped up and brought to the emergency room, and the hospital has legal responsibility to provide care to those people, even though the government refuses to pay for it. It's an interesting system. So what happens is that those people who do have insurance, or those people who do have money to pay, will actually end up paying through cost shifting for those individuals. But we have these four different systems, and they're all mixed up, and they're all... and we have the for-profit all mixed in there. Every other developed country has one model on a theory that it's simpler, cheaper, and fairer. We have all these different models, including somewhere around close to 20% of the population having their only coverage is out of pocket. And we know that many of those people, if not the majority of the people, are the working poor. Okay, so just very briefly, the common principles in developed countries, they have a unified system, they have one system that works. They have non-profit financing, they've taken the profit out of it. Does it make any sense to be running all these insurance companies creaming 20% off the top all the way through just for administrative costs and for profit? They have universal coverage. And you have to have universal coverage before you can really hit cost control. And they set limits in some way. Budget limits, regulation, or ration. We do not have unlimited. There is no country that has unlimited resources to meet all the demands of all the people and all the things that they want. And how is that going to be achieved? We do that right now primarily through the out-of-pocket part of medicine. So that we ration people. Is there a lesson for us in there? Yeah, we don't have a healthcare system. We have all these overlapping programs and reliance on for-profit systems. And where are we going to go? We need a major overhaul of our healthcare system. It's bankrupting the United States at the present time. It's bankrupting the individual states. And so the second point, I think it's an important one. And despite what its critics argue, the ACA, which is the Obamacare, that's the Affordable Care Act of 2010, it wasn't an overhaul. And it certainly wasn't a takeover of the healthcare system by the government. it was simply a reform of the insurance industry, which was largely supported by the insurance industry. If you remember, the insurance industry signed on very early to Obama's plan and to the plan that was ultimately passed, because they knew we were going to expand coverage to almost everybody, and it was going to be done through the private for-profit insurance company. I mean, it was a no-lose situation for them. So it was simply a reform of the insurance. They had to give something up, but they were getting a lot for it, and it really didn't make very much of a change in our process. So all this yelling and screaming about it is a lot of nonsense. It really wasn't that big a deal. So what do we need? We need universal coverage. We've got to get the for-profit motive out of the insurance plans. We need to concentrate on evidence-based, cost-effective medicine. And we've got to set limits. Do we have the will to do it in the United States? Do we have the will to do it in Holden Village? Do we have the will to do it in the United States? I don't know. I am not optimistic, but I think we're going to have to do something, because we're otherwise going to break the bank.
We do it at Holden Village.
Thank you.
Not everyone has such good explanations.
So we've got a couple minutes here. Any questions in the back of the room? Are you just stretching?
I just have that a comment. I experienced living in the last two systems, the
out of pocket and the national health insurance.
The national health plan and then out of pocket. In the country of Botswana, I know you just had a comment about Zimbabwe. I lived next door for 9 years, and as an example, they have a national coverage at a certain level, so that for those services covered, you pay 50 cents approximately when you see a doctor. If you want something special, like a transplant or whatever, you pay out of pocket. I was bitten by a rabid dog and had to start the shots, and you observe it for 10 days, so you start your shots in between. I paid 50 cents for 3 shots each, and that was covered by that plan. And I was just amazed that I could do that there, where here, that shot would have cost me a lot more money in the United States.
What country was that?
Botswana. Which is also has a big problem with longevity right now because of the AIDS crisis, mm-hmm. But outside of that, they really lifted their life expectancy into the 60s from 29, and now it's dropped back lower than 50 because of the AIDS crisis. Outside of that, they still have that national plan.
And you can have dramatic improvements. When young people die, have dramatic improvements on overall life expectancy. It really skews it. So changing childhood mortality has just a huge impact. And AIDS, because it kills so many people in their 30s and working... any other questions or comments? Yes.
In some of the other models, can providers be sued? Because it seems the threat of malpractice lawsuits really drives up the cost of health care, too.
I have a slide somewhere, and I didn't include it, which shows the number of lawyers per 1,000 people.
Yes,
I think, you know, there's something like, you know, I mean, there are more lawyers in New York City than there are in Japan. In the whole country, it's phenomenal. I mean, it's part of our culture almost more than what the system. The system, in all these places, allow, medical liability suits to go forward. We just have a very litigious society, and we also have a healthcare system in which we almost set ourselves up. The providers and the patients set themselves up in an adversarial.
Yeah.
Role. Almost from the beginning. Yes.
Well, in the VA system, providers cannot be sued. Isn't that correct?
In the military, you can't be sued. And the VA, I think the VA can be sued, but it has a limit on. I mean, there are very strict limits. Texas has very strict limits on what the reward for pain and suffering can be. And that's supposed to have a big, you know, the people say it's going to have a big impact on costs and things like that. It turns out it doesn't. People still sue and doctors still practice defensive medicine because they're afraid of being sued. Yes?
Do you think there's any ethic in the country that says we want to do the best for the most number that we can as opposed to we want to have the best?
Boy, that's a great question, and one that we could spend a lot of time talking about, and how you go and try to achieve that. Anybody from Oregon here besides Gay and me? The Oregon Health Plan, with the Governor Kitzhaber established a number of years ago, was set for Medicaid to ration services as opposed to ration people. Medicare system and Medicaid system all across the country have a certain amount of money, and they raise, and if depending on how much money they have and how many people are eligible, they change the eligibility based upon the poverty level. And they keep raising and lowering. If a family of four earns more than $8,000 a year, they're not eligible. Less than $8,000, they are. That's for 1 year. The next year, they might change it to 12 or change it to 9, or, mm-hmm. depending on how much money's in the system. And so people that qualify get everything they want, and people who don't qualify get zero. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, Oregon, and good old Oregon, decided, they had a lot of public meetings and said, let's rank the 560 most common procedures and treatments according to what the public thinks and what physicians think and what the medical care system thinks are most beneficial. So we put at the very top, we had prenatal care and immunizations. At the very bottom was surgery for chronic back pain and plastic surgery and a few other things. So they ranked them. And then we try to insure everybody that's in the Medicare system. And you went up and down that list so that you may only cover the top 250 things on the list, and you're not going to cover those things below, but you covered everybody. So that everybody got the immunizations, everybody got that was in the Medicaid system. And the idea eventually this was to go to everybody in the state, that this kind of thing. It hasn't fared well because a lot of people think this is rationing, and but we ration anyway. We ration people as opposed to rationing services. We really have to ration services and cover everybody.
How long has that been in effect in Oregon?
Since the early to mid-90s. But it hasn't been adequately funded. You know how things are. It's a great idea, and it's something that really needs to be applied so that you have a limited package, through basic medical care that everybody would get would be a limited package. You get appendicitis, they're going to take your appendix out. You're not going to go bankrupt over it. Yeah. You have a heart attack, you'll be taken care of. You're pregnant, you're going to get prenatal care. But if you're 85 years old and you've got metastatic cancer and now you've got heart disease, you are not going to get bypass surgery. That's going to extend your life for 2 months, and then you're going to die of your cancer. Just because you're healthy. Right now, you can get it if your surgeon's willing to do it and you want it. And the government will pay for it. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
I think the other thing that raises...
Lara, please.
I think another thing that raises healthcare costs that people don't think about, too, is it's not only the physicians that have to carry malpractice insurance, it's the specialized physicians that have to carry additional malpractice insurance, like... OBGYNs have to carry a special malpractice insurance for, delivering babies and that type of thing. But also nurses have to carry malpractice insurance, and every nurse should carry their own malpractice insurance because that raises the cost of healthcare because nurses can be sued on top of the physician being sued if they carry out a physician's order. They can get sued for that, for causing harm. So that raises malpractice, that raises healthcare costs. The other thing that people don't think about is when the physician does it depends on what insurance you have, but if you don't have insurance, when you get hospitalized, say for something, or you get a procedure done, you either A, get everything that you use bundled together. So say you have a procedure done and you use this, and this item in that procedure. you're either A, going to get all those items bundled together for that procedure, or hospitalization bundled together in that one bill, and the procedure is going to cover that. So say you have the bypass surgery and you get hospitalized for so many days, everything in the hospitalization is going to get covered that for your insurance. But say your insurance doesn't cover that, and the nurses use all this stuff, your insurance may not cover all that, everything that the nurse used to take care of you. So IV kits, Tylenol, you know what I'm saying? Everything is going to get, and that raises the cost of healthcare and everything that they use. And each time that happens, I mean, the insurance companies are saying, oh, look, for this one procedure, it's costing more and more and more and more every time this procedure gets done. And so, I mean, if nurses or hospitals aren't doing things cost effectively, insurance companies are seeing that they're using more and more stuff. It's a problem. Yeah. It's a problem. So people, if nurses and things, or doctors too, when they're doing procedures, aren't being cost effective or aren't being wise with the things that they're using.
I think there was one more question. Did you have a question in the back?
I'm just curious. Is there a group of professional or industries that are opposed strongly to universal health care in this country? From your experience, do you have a take on that?
We spend $2 trillion on health care under the present system. Anybody that is benefiting from the current system is afraid of change. We're all afraid of change, any kind of change. We don't like it. That's just a human nature. And if you're being well rewarded, whether you're a pharmaceutical executive or a cardiac surgeon or a hospital employee or a nurse or anybody that's in a system, that anything that may change that is going to be a threat. So yes, there are all kinds of people but no one's going to come out and say, well, I want to keep the poor uninsured and let them suffer. And no, nobody says that. But their actions achieve that.
Right.
So I hope this has stimulated some thought and discussion. And we can wrap it up.